The shuttle breakup was a stunning blow to Israel. With the country's first ever astronaut aboard, Israel had rallied around this space mission as a badly needed diversion from the daily news of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Israeli Air Force Colonel Ilan Ramon became a national hero as the shuttle lifted off, and his family became the focus of national mourning today. NPR's Peter Kenyon is in Jerusalem and has this report.
Ilan Ramon's presence on the Columbia was born of tragedy. After the assassination of former Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, Shimon Peres traveled to Washington and was promised by President Bill Clinton that NASA would include an Israeli astronaut in its space shuttle program. Ilan Ramon was chosen for the job in 1997. After 113 shuttle missions, this space voyage was not seen by many Americans as anything exceptional. But in Israel, the 28th Columbia mission was riveting front-page news, and the 48-year-old astronaut was accorded hero status and the kind of concern that followed John Glenn into space in 1962. In an interview before the launch, Ramon said his profession often astonished people he would meet.
I meet a lot of Holocaust survivors, for instance, Jewish people here in the United States. You can see in their eyes, they really don't believe that I'm an astronaut, because for them it's out of the world. So for Israel and for the Jewish community, it's a very symbolical event.
Ramon comes from a family of Holocaust survivors, including his father, his mother, and grandmother. His wife Rona gave him four poems to take with him into space. Shortly after the mission began, she spoke of a voicemail message her husband had left on the family phone. He told me they were eating, they were excited and happy, she said. He told us that he loves us so much and he's looking forward to seeing us in February. Ramon's father, 70-year-old Eliezer Wolferman, was doing his part to acknowledge the nation's first space traveler. As the shuttle re-entered the Earth's atmosphere, he was seated in an Israeli television studio, talking about the email messages he had received from his son. Suddenly, the station's correspondent in Florida broke in with the first bulletin that something was wrong. Ramon's father grew quiet as the urgent bulletins continued, and he was led out of the studio. In later interviews, he maintained a quiet dignity, patiently accepting the grief and condolences that poured forth from all who talked with him. The Israeli Air Force organized a flight for family members to join Ramon's wife and four children in Florida. Prime Minister Sharon spoke with President Bush and shared condolences for the families of all seven astronauts. Among the many items lost with the Columbia crew today was a small pencil drawing entitled Moon Landscape. It was drawn by a 14-year-old Jewish boy named Peter Ginz shortly before he died in Auschwitz. On his last mission for Israel, Colonel Ilan Ramon carried that drawing into space. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Jerusalem.
And now we want to bring you up to date on the latest information that we have here. Officials say there is no immediate indication as to what caused the space shuttle Columbia to break apart today just after it re-entered the Earth's atmosphere. The seven astronauts on board were killed. We heard earlier some of the indications from NPR's Joe Palca, indications of problems with sensors on the left wing. There had been indications of trouble with the left wing during the takeoff of the challenge of the Columbia some days before. And so that is one immediate area where officials will be looking, but again, it's impossible to say, according to NASA and other officials, what caused this disaster. Salvage crews, including U.S. Army troops, are fanning out tonight across a 60-mile-wide debris field in East Texas. Residents in the area being warned not to touch any debris. Many of the substances used on the shuttle are toxic. A couple of F-16 fighters from an Air Force Reserve unit in Fort Worth joined the effort to search for pieces of the shuttle during daylight today. The Army's 1st Cavalry Division also sent out a search and rescue task force from Fort Hood, Texas, to help search for debris. The task force included helicopters and military police searching for and guarding pieces of wreckage for collection by NASA. Black Hawk helicopters flying over Texas today. The U.S. government has appointed an independent board to investigate the Space Shuttle Columbia disaster. Experts from the Air Force and Navy, which had five of the seven crew members, will join officials from the Transportation Department and other federal agencies on that review panel. President Bush today echoed the sentiments of NASA officials and many Americans in a nationally broadcast speech. He said that news of the tragedy has brought great sadness to the country. You're listening to NPR News. This is special coverage of the Shuttle Columbia disaster from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. And former astronaut Jim Prowelczyk is back with us again. Mr. Prowelczyk, welcome once again.
Good evening.
I've been fascinated and interested and saddened reading some of the brief biographies of some of these astronauts, several of whom I know you knew. And what interests me most is what caused some of them to want to go into space. Rick Husband, for example, told an interviewer that this is something he wanted to do ever since he was a child. I'm interested, first off, in your case, if you can tell me what it was that caused you to want to go into space.
Well, I think what you heard from Rick Husband on that interview is not uncommon. Many astronauts share a dream and a desire from flight from a very early age. I think anybody who grew up through the 60s, as I did, were certainly captivated by the possibilities of space flight and looked as this is a new way to explore, to stretch a little bit further, and all the people today are certainly in that spirit.
When you're around your fellow astronauts, do you talk about your fascination with this, the kind of childish fascination, or does it the culture of NASA require to be a little more tough than that?
I don't know that it's a culture of that. I don't know if you sit around with your fellow interviewers and try to decide what it was in your background that brought you all to radio or television.
Somebody asked me, it actually kind of bothers me from time to time.
Astronauts don't spend much time sitting around talking about those things. Everybody has their individual motivations in life. They come together as a professional group. It is probably the most talented group of people that I have ever worked with my entire life. Also one of the funnest group as well. Dedicated to the things that they do, absolutely fanatical about doing it as well as they possibly can, and living life to its fullest.
There are frequently news stories, Mr. Pwelczyk, about how NASA is not as much of a focus of national attention as it once was, and how the budget is not what it might have been, and how the ambition of the space program is not what it might have been. But I wonder how it looked to you when you were on the inside. If this was a place that everybody felt like they were doing amazing work, or if it was some other way.
I think you see a lot of different aspects of this. Certainly, in order to conduct a space launch, it's a large organization, and so you see a lot of different aspects of it, and there's complexities to it, like any other large organization. But what I was truly impressed with, and remain truly impressed with, is the almost fanatical dedication to safety. You heard earlier today Ron Dittmore, the shuttle manager, talking about his team and the kinds of things that they've been considering and what they'll be going back to look at to do. A lot of people are bleeding tonight and just in hurting for the families of the crew and the crew members that we've lost, and they're taking it personally, as they always do every moment.
I suppose this must be a little like a plane crash, in which investigators always say a plane crash is a one in a million event. If you could forecast what was going to cause the crash, it probably wouldn't have happened.
Well, sure. If we knew those things, we wouldn't happen. The vehicle is checked out thoroughly before flight. As I'm sure many have mentioned before, this is certainly one of the most complex machines that people have ever created. And things do happen with it all the time. Most of the time, they're very small things. And unfortunately, in this case, that was not to be.
Mr. Pwelczyk, thanks again.
You're welcome.
And let's try to reconstruct what little we do know so far about what happened in this incident. NASA officials scrambled today to put together a timeline of what has happened in the hours and minutes leading up to the explosion of Columbia. They offered pieces of that timeline at a couple of press conferences, one in Florida, where the shuttle was supposed to land, the other in Texas, where it was last seen intact. As NPR's John Hamilton reports, the information so far tells the story of a mission that seemed to be going flawlessly until the final minutes.
NASA officials say it was a near-perfect morning to land in Florida. Ron Dittmore, manager of the space shuttle program, says there was a little fog as the shuttle began to re-enter the atmosphere, but nothing to worry about.
The first indications of a potential problem occurred minutes before 8 o'clock Central Standard Time.
At 7:53, readings from the craft showed the failure of temperature sensors in the hydraulic systems in the left wing.
They were followed seconds and minutes later by several other problems, including loss of tire pressure indications on the left main gear, and then indications of excessive structural heating.
the shuttle was still functioning normally. Members of the crew sent a message indicating they were aware of the troubling readings at about 9 a.m. Bill Reedy, NASA's Associate Administrator for Spaceflight, says that was the last communication with the shuttle.
We heard that they had lost data from the spacecraft, and it appears that that was at about 200,000 feet, about Mach 18.
More than 12,000 miles per hour. Pictures of the shuttle as it passed over Texas show the craft breaking apart. Reedy says NASA took action almost immediately.
At the planned landing time of 9:16, we initiated our contingency action plan, called the Rescue Coordination Center, and initiated a search and rescue effort. Sadly, I think from the video that's available, it does not appear that there were any survivors.
Today's fuzzy images of falling debris are odd companions to those shot in 1986, when the space shuttle Challenger was captured exploding into flames soon after it took off. Reedy says today's incident offers a sobering reminder.
And after 113 flights, unfortunately, people have a tendency to look at it as something that is more or less routine. Well, I can assure you it is not.
Now, NASA officials say their task is to find out what caused the crash and fix it. One possibility is a piece of foam insulation from the shuttle's fuel tank. During takeoff, it broke free and struck the shuttle's left wing, the same wing where sensors first indicated a problem. NASA officials say there was no reason to believe there was damage to the wing. NASA Administrator Sean O'Keefe refused to speculate about what brought down Columbia, though he did rule out some things.
At this time, we have no indication that the mishap was caused by anything or anyone on the ground.
O'Keefe says a task force has already been formed to investigate the crash. He says he and other officials have spoken about the investigation with family members of the shuttle's crew.
We have assured them that we will begin the process immediately to recover their loved ones and understand the cause of this tragedy.
NASA is asking for help from the public. It has appealed to anyone who has video of the shuttle's flight to contact the agency. Anyone who finds a piece of debris should not move or touch it, but contact local authorities immediately. John Hamilton, NPR News, Washington.
We want to go now to NPR's John Burnett. He was at one of those briefings we just mentioned, the NASA briefing this afternoon at the Johnson Space Center in Houston, Texas. He's also talked to several NASA employees. John, I want to begin with some atmospherics. What was it like to spend the day at the Johnson Space Center today?
Hi, Steve. It was really quite an amazing press conference. I've covered many of these over the years, and the fact that the flight director for the Johnson Space Center, Milt Heflin, and the program manager for the space shuttle, Ron Ditmore, spent nearly 2 hours on this day when they were both clearly grieving themselves, answering very technical questions. It was quite remarkable, and I think some of the reporters there were, you know, pleased that there was so much information that they were attempting to give out on this first day. And just the mood inside the room, just incredibly somber. Mr. Heflin in particular was very ashen-faced. I think he really described it when he said that human spaceflight is a passion here at the Johnson Space Center outside of Houston. It's an emotional event for all of us. We have a dependency, professional and emotional. And an event like today, when we lose 7 people, is devastating. And you could really sense this here in this campus.
It is impressive that they spent 2 hours answering our small questions when it was so clear that the very large questions can't be answered today.
Right, and you can feel the sort of the outpouring from the community here down in Clear Lake City, which is just east of Houston. I mean, it's an old cliche about how NASA is a family here, but you really sense that when something like this happens there. The front gate, people are coming, and they've turned it into a sort of a shrine. They're leaving wreaths and notes, and there's a long line of people wanting to somehow, remember the people in this place on this terrible day.
People who have no access to the Space Center are just coming to the front gate and standing there. No chance to get in, but they just want to be there.
That's right. They just in almost in the way that they reacted to 9/11, that you just they wanted to show the nation that they care, and so they're coming out with these wreaths and these expressions of emotion. One of the things that happens on a terrible day like this at NASA is that the astronaut corps is almost military-like in its unity and in the family nature. And so there was a person here at Johnson Space Center whose job it was to call every single member of the astronaut corps, many of whose families live right around Houston, and to tell them individually, as though they would tell the family of someone who lost an astronaut, that we have had this tragedy and we've lost these astronauts. And then there are astronauts who travel with the families of the Columbia victims who actually go to the launches and the landings. And so there have been astronauts that accompanied them back to Houston today. So it's to talk about the close-knit nature of the astronaut corps, those that are on the ground and those that are up in space, you can't overestimate that.
John, in the few seconds we have left, tell me a little bit more about the NASA community in Houston. You mentioned that it is the place where a great many of the astronauts now live.
Well, they do, and this is the same thing that happened. I was here in 1986 after the Challenger disaster, and again, you feel this sense of this pulling together, of this emotional support that they talked about in the press briefing today. And the main difference now is that, as I recall, the Challenger explosion happened on a weekday. This was a weekend. Only the core mission team was here at JSC today. And so there was employees from many departments streaming into this enormous campus out here in the grasslands east of Houston, and now this has become a very busy place.
NPR's John Burnett. John, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Steve.
And next we want to hear the voices of two of the astronauts themselves. Seven astronauts died today, and earlier this week, NPR's Tavis Smiley spoke with two of them from space, pilot William Willie McCool, a Navy commander from Lubbock, Texas, and payload commander Michael Anderson, a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force from Spokane, Washington. Here's a little of their conversation.
Willie, this is your first space flight, I understand. How does your experience compare with what you expected?
There is so much more than what I ever expected. It's beyond imagination until you actually get up and see it and experience it and feel it. So I would say the things that are new to me are the zero-G type changes to my body and the zero-G changes to the things that we do routinely day-to-day that you can only imagine, but you can't really quite imagine it quite right until you get up and do it.
Mike, you're the payload commander of this mission. What exactly does a payload commander do?
Well, if I could show you in the back of the shuttle, you'd see our laboratory. And back there, we have hundreds of experiments, and those are our payloads. So my job is to manage those experiments and to make sure everything gets done properly. So with the help of all my crewmates, that's where we spend most of our time each day, in the payload bay, working on those experiments. Really, the job started well before flight, working with the scientists and engineers and making sure that the payloads were designed properly and that we were going to get the right results on orbit. So far, I have to tell you, we've been really pleased with what we're seeing. We're exceeding almost all of our expectations, and we're getting some really good science.
Willie, I understand you're doing an experiment involving African dust. Now, you got to tell me, what's that about?
Well, believe it or not, there's a lot of dust in the air, and it contributes significantly, we think, to the temperature of the Earth. And it may have impacts on global warming. So we're looking specifically at dust that comes out of the North African Sahara area that migrates across the jet streams, across the Atlantic Ocean, up into the Mediterranean. And we have some radiometric cameras that measure the reflectivity of that dust to see how it reflects the sunlight from the Earth's atmosphere.
Mike is one of the seven active African-American astronauts. What do you see as the future of African-Americans in space?
Well, that's a good question. I see the future as being pretty bright. As you mentioned, there are seven of us. Bob Kerbin will be flying in just a few months. Then, of course, later in the year, we'll have Joan Higginbotham flying. And early next year, you'll see Stephanie Wilson flying. So it looks like the future is really bright. And not only that, we also have some research that I think will be really beneficial to the African-American community. On board this flight, we have a bioreactor, which is flying prostate cancer cells, and prostate cancer is a high rate of occurrence in African-American males, and hopefully from some of the research we're doing up here, we can really help out in those areas.
Thank you both, and enjoy the flight.
Thank you, Travis.
Astronauts Michael Anderson and William McCool speaking earlier this week with NPR's Tavis Smiley. We want to remind you that there are now two investigations of this disaster. The government appointed an independent board on Saturday, today, to investigate the Space Shuttle Columbia disaster, and the Space Agency itself will also conduct its own investigation into the disaster. Both will review all the information NASA collected today. Seven astronauts died today when the shuttle broke up, but it's not really the number of dead that stays in your mind. It's the astounding scale of their aspirations. The astronauts traveled on a shuttle made in the 1970s, one of the leftovers from a scaled-back space program. And yet just the other day, as we heard, shuttle pilot Willie McCool phoned back to the ground and said he was calling from the dark side of the Earth. On another day, Israeli astronaut Ilan Ramon called down as the shuttle passed over Jerusalem. From the shuttle, two cameras recorded dust in the air over the Mediterranean Sea. Inside the shuttle, experimental rosebuds traveled inside a miniature greenhouse. The astronauts were instructed to see if the red roses bloomed. The crew included an immigrant from India, one of the first black astronauts, and a naval officer who worked in submarines before he traveled in space. And then there was Commander Rick Hubbard, husband, who said that he grew up dreaming about space. He became an Air Force pilot first, but never let go of the dream to travel higher.